doesn't go that far. And Justice Jackson wrote this very famous concurring opinion in which he set out the various levels of presidential power and said that the president is at his weakest level of power when Congress has legislated in a field. And at several points today, Judge Alito cited that, referring to it as a twilight of the president's power, but he never said the president really doesn't have much power at that moment. And that's really where the Senate has yet to pin him down, because what the president said specifically, and I've got it in front of me in his signing statement, when he signed the bill that included the McCain anti-torture provision, the president said, "The executive branch shall construe this provision in a manner consistent with the constitutional authority of the president to supervise the unitary executive branch and as commander-in-chief and consistent with the constitutional limitations on the judicial power which will assist in achieving the shared objective on the Congress and the president evidenced in Title 10, blah, 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 blah." Mm-hmm. The point being here that it's very hard to know from what Judge Alito said. It's very hard for me to be able to tell anyway so far whether when he talks about the unitary executive as being simply that Congress can't impose its controls on how the executive controls itself, whether that includes when Congress passes laws that impose limits on the president's ability to be the chief law enforcement officer in the country, for example. Therefore, they created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to say anytime you want to do electronic surveillance, you have to go through the courts, either prospectively or retroactively, but you got to go through the courts because you can't be judge, jury, and executioner. And it's not clear to me from what Judge Alito said whether that, in his view, would exceed the power of Congress under the theory of the so-called unitary executive.
Yes, I couldn't tell whether he was just stopping, going right up to the edge and stopping on the theory that I shouldn't decide this case, I'm not going to tell you how I rule, or he was really stopping because he didn't really want to tell us what he thought about that. But I did think that...
Or was he using fancy words?
Well, if you start with Jackson's opinion in the Steele seizure case, that strikes me as very good news for people who... don't want to have unlimited executive power, because mm-hmm. that's the most important opinion in the 20th century, where the Supreme Court basically said the president doesn't have this endless power in wartime. Yes, he's commander-in-chief of the military overseas, but that doesn't make him the commander-in-chief of the people at home on the home front during something that's a war. A lot of President Bush's lawyers have talked about various World War II precedents, the Nazi saboteurs case, and basically said the president can order the arrest of people in the United States and call them enemy combatants because it's all part of his commander-in-chief power. I think it's good to have both John Roberts and now Sam Alito come up here, and when they're asked about presidential power, they talk about Jackson's opinion and say and make the point, when Congress acts and reins in the president's power is at its weakest. But you're right to say, Nina, he doesn't go on to say, therefore, NSA wiretapping sure looks illegal and unconstitutional because Congress said the exclusive means is to go through the FISA court.
And then in the other opinion that's being mentioned, and of course Sandra Day O'Connor in the Hamdi case said the time of war does not give the president a blank check on the individual rights of Americans. And he said he absolutely agreed with that.
He didn't necessarily agree with Sandra Day O'Connor. He agreed that that the Constitution does not give the president a blank check. But what is a blank check? That is really where the devil is in the details. Even in the case of detaining American citizens indefinitely, incommunicado, without, you know, due process rights, one might have thought that the Hamdi case, which involved a guy seized in Afghanistan but who was an American citizen, would have resolved it. But it, of course, didn't, because then we got the Padilla case, which involved a guy who was an American citizen seized on American soil, and the Bush administration has very artfully recently prevented that case at least so far, from going to the Supreme Court. They are they've now charged him 3.5 years later in an effort to really avoid the case getting decided by the highest court. Of course, it's still sitting there. It could be.
Mm-hmm. You know, Nina, we were talking about what he did say. I was surprised he didn't say a little more on the signing statements question. He was asked about it several times, and then he went back to the mid-'80s and said, well, that was part of a working mm-hmm. group, and we were considering this and considering that. What they were really asking him was, Judge, do you think the president can issue a signing statement that basically changes the law and says, well, I'm as president, I don't actually have to abide by all the provisions? I thought he could have said something to say, all I was saying is that the president is an equal to the Congress and should have some sense of how the law, how I understand the law being passed by Congress. But I certainly didn't mean, as President Bush seems to say, is that the president can sort of sign a law and say, by the way, I'm actually not going to abide by it.
Well, you know, this whole working group that he refers to was part of a Reagan administration effort to expand presidential power and use a whole bunch of new tools to do it. And one of the things that they did, in a rather limited way, was to have these signing statements saying, well, I really don't think that what the Congress passed here is constitutional, or I reinterpret it to mean this because that would be unconstitutional. In other words, to put a new coloration on the laws by virtue of a presidential signing statement. And this president, President George W. Bush, has done that to a fairly well. But the interesting thing, as Judge Alito noted, is that the Supreme Court has never said whether that has any impact whatsoever. It has done a whole lot of other things that suggested that a law is a law when Congress passes it, and the president can veto it or not veto it, but he can't. He can't line-item veto, he can't impound funds, he can't do a whole bunch of other stuff. But it has never said, look, we won't take into consideration the signing statement. And he very carefully left that open today.
These will be among the issues that were expected to come up later this afternoon. Of course, we're here in Washington, Eastern Time, afternoon here. Judge Alito is back in his chair at a small table in front of the raised U-shaped table at which the Senate Judiciary Committee sits. Photographers are gathered around to snap their pictures. Members of his family are sitting in the row directly behind him and to his right. They include his wife and his sister and his children and his wife's parents and, of course, the Senate escort who's been with him throughout this process, former Senator Dan Coats, a Republican of Indiana, who's been with him. A few of the senators and their staffs are getting back into the room. Senator Kyle, who will be the first questioner when the hearing resumes, is already going over his notes, and I see Senator Spector ready to resume the chair. Arlen Specter, of course, Republican of Pennsylvania, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, glancing meaningfully at his watch and picking up the gavel.
The Judiciary Committee hearings will resume. We'll turn now to Senator Kyle, who has 20 more minutes on his first round of 30 minutes. Senator Kyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, let me ask unanimous consent to put three items in the record. One of these items related to, two of them relate to the matter of the CAP that we've heard something about. I'd like to enter into the record two letters by Democratic attorneys that make clear that Judge Alito has been extremely helpful in advancing the interest of women and minorities. One letter notes that as U.S. attorney, he put women and minorities in supervisory positions. The other is from a president-elect of the National Bar Association for Women, and also a Washington Post article from January 9th in which criminal defense lawyer and Democrat Alberto Rivas, who served in the U.S. Attorney's Office when Judge Alito was in charge, said, speaking of the judge, while he opposed numeric hiring quotas, he took steps to diversify an office that had the reputation as something of a white boys' club. Mr. Chairman, I hope that this will help address what I think is almost getting to be
without objection, they will be made a part of the record.
Thank you. Secondly, there's been some discussion of this Knight Ritter article that has, to my understanding, been rather completely discredited, and I ask unanimous consent that the attached document analyzing that article be added to the record.
Without objection, it will be made a part of the record.
And before the break, Senator Biden suggested that there, at least I understood him, to suggest that there was no reason to belong to this organization, CAP, in 1985 because ROTC was safely on campus at that time. Judge, let me ask you a question. Do you know what year you joined the CAP?
I don't know, Senator. I've tried to rack my memory about that. But as I said, if I'd been active in my membership, I think I certainly would remember that. And if I had renewed the membership, I think I would remember that. So my best reconstruction of this is that it probably was sometime around the time when I wrote that statement in 1985.
Long after you were gone from the school.
That's correct.
In that event, Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent to include in the record an article from a campus newspaper, the Princeton Packet, dated February 12, 1985, which expressly explains that ROTC was a core motivation behind the CAP in 1985.
Without objection, it will be made a part of the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noted with interest a comment that Senator Durbin made in his opening statement because it referred to a good friend and former colleague of ours, Senator Simon, who put forth a pretty good test about courts. He said that the real test is the court restricting freedom or expanding it. And I thought about that because it seems to me that so many of these cases about expanding freedom or restricting it are cases that boil down to the eye of the beholder. And I specifically thought about the Ninth Circuit case because my state is from the Ninth Circuit, outlawing under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, saying that that's unconstitutional. And I checked, according to the one survey that I had access to, 93% of the American people support the right to say under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. And I know that the plaintiff in the case, Michael Newdow, thought that he was advancing his freedom or his daughter's freedom in successfully getting the court to strike it down. But it seems to me that the majority of the people are having their freedom restricted in such a case. And it seems to me, and I certainly won't ask you because that case could well come before the court again. I wouldn't ask you how you would rule on it. But as a general proposition, this matter of restricting freedom, is it not the case that in many situations you've got two competing types of freedom or liberty involved, and it's a question of interpreting the Constitution rather than specifically setting out to advance one sort of freedom as opposed to another?
I think that's exactly right, Senator. Often there are conflicting freedoms, and that makes the case difficult.
Let me ask you, too. There was a concern expressed by Senator Biden that the big factor in your nomination, in his view, was the fact that you would be replacing Justice Sandra O'Connor, and that might mean that you would change the direction of the court. That's the concern expressed anyway. Now, as has been famously said, I know Justice O'Connor. I've been a friend of hers for at least 30 years, and I don't think she is any kind of a liberal member of the court. She might properly be called moderately conservative. I'm not sure how she'd characterize herself. But I noted that of the 109 justices to sit on the Supreme Court, nearly half, 46 to be exact, have replaced judges appointed by another political party. So it is not at all uncommon. Indeed, it is almost half the situations in which a different party nominates the justice replacing a sitting judge or justice, and one might expect, therefore, some difference. But I checked the record because this had been brought up by Senator Brownback yesterday, and I found in the nomination of Justice Ginsburg and the confirmation hearings there, she replaced Justice White, who I think rightly has been called a centrist on the court, certainly not a liberal. And yet I heard or I saw not one expression of concern by any senator, Democrat or Republican, that Justice Ginsburg might be ruling quite a bit differently than Justice White in decisions in the court. So it seems to me that is not a test that is rightly applied. That's a results-oriented test, exactly the same kind of thing that you have said that judges shouldn't do when they approach cases. Let me get to a point that Senator Kennedy made. He said that you've been overly deferential to executive power. and criticized what he called, and I think I have this quotation exactly, your almost total disregard of the impact of these powers on the rights of individuals. I'd like to know what your response is to that charge and whether you can cite some specific cases that would refute what he said.
Well, certainly, Senator. I've tried to decide every case on its own merits, and sometimes that means siding with the government, and sometimes it means siding with the party who's claiming a violation of rights. And I do it on an individual basis. Cases that show that I don't, do that are cases like United States versus Cathcart, which was a case in which an African American man had been stopped by police officers because there had been a description of some robbery suspects, and they were described as the perpetrator was described as a black man in a black car, and Mr. Cathcart was a black man in a black car, and they thought that was sufficient to stop the car. And I wrote an opinion saying that that was insufficient, and that was basically racial profiling and was not permitted. Another example is Bolden versus Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, which had to do with a drug test. And I found that the test there constituted a search and a seizure and would be a violation absent consent on the part of the party who was searched. There have been a number of criminal cases in which I've sided with the person claiming a violation of rights. Carpenter versus Vaughn was a case in which I wrote an opinion reversing a death penalty. I joined an opinion reversing a death penalty. The Bronstein case was another case that came up fairly recently in which I joined an opinion reversing a death penalty. There have been quite a few cases of this nature, Senator.
I noted a tax case, too, or a case involving tax evasion, Levito versus Lapina. Do you remember that 2001 case?
I do. That was the case in which there was a search of, I believe it was the office of a veterinarian. And in a way, that is a similar case to the Malott case that I was discussing earlier, although in Malott I thought that the search was carried out properly. In the Levito case, on the facts of that case, I thought the search was not carried out properly, that the officers violated the Fourth Amendment in the way they went about carrying out that search. They forced the occupants of these premises to remain on the premises for a very extended period of time while the search was being conducted, and violated their Fourth Amendment rights. And that's what I said in the opinion.
Do you have an idea of how many cases that have gone to decision that you've participated in on your 15 years as a circuit court judge?
I think it's well over 4,000 on the merits.
I suspect that in those 4,000 cases, there might be one or two that I disagree with your decisions on, maybe even more than that. But the point here is there are numerous cases in which you have found that the government acted improperly in criminal law contexts, in warrant contexts, in discrimination contexts, in other cases in which you have found either that the government acted properly or that, at a minimum, government officials were entitled to some immunity with respect to being privately sued. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator.
Let me also address this question of discrimination, especially racial discrimination. This is a matter that was discussed in some prior questioning, and specifically in Senator Biden's questions, it dealt with the Sheridan case, in which you were the sole dissenter. In the subsequent United States Supreme Court case, the Reeves decision, my understanding from your answer is that the Supreme Court addressed the same issue of law that you and your colleagues had disagreed about, and that the U.S. Supreme Court voted unanimously in an opinion written by Justice O'Connor that the test that you used in the Sheridan case was the correct test to use. Is that correct?
Yes, correct, Senator, that is correct.
Now, there are some other cases involving employees claiming racial discrimination that that I've looked at, and one of the senators seemed to suggest in a comment that he made that you had never written opinions or decided cases for a black plaintiff. Is that a fair statement?
No, it's not accurate.
Do you recall cases that in which you upheld the discrimination claims of racial minorities?
There was the case of Goosby versus Johnson & Johnson, and that case could be considered together with the Bray case that I was discussing before the break. Those were both cases in which my colleague Judge McKee wrote the opinion, and in the Goosby case, I agreed with him. It was a similar case, but it was a case where I thought the facts fell on the other side of the line. There was a case called Smith versus Davis, which was another case where I joined an opinion upholding the claim of an African-American who was claiming racial discrimination. The Robinson case involved claims of race and gender discrimination. As I recall, there are a number of cases in the criminal law context. I just mentioned the Kithcart case. There was the Brinson case. There was Williams versus Price. There have been many cases involving other forms of discrimination, age discrimination, the Showalter case, disability discrimination, the Manzaluski case, the case of Shapiro versus Lakewood Township. There was Zuby versus AT&T, which was a case involving the statute of limitations for a claim of racial discrimination.
And you were the lone dissenter in that case, is that correct?
I was the dissenter in that case.
And
that
your position was what?
My position was that the majority's position was that the claim had to be thrown out because the statute of limitations had been violated. And my position was that the claim should be allowed to go forward because the statute of limitations was longer than the majority had recognized. And that case, that issue, later went to the Supreme Court in a case called Jones versus Donnelly, and the Supreme Court agreed with my position that the longer statute of limitations applied.
I note there was another case involving an African-American woman who claimed that her coworkers had made racial and sexual slurs against her, denied her training opportunities, and so on. And you ruled that she was entitled to $124,000 in damages and attorney's fees, a case called Reynolds versus USX Corporation. Do you remember that case?
That's right, Senator.
So the bottom line is there are numerous cases in which you have ruled in favor of minorities, in particular African-Americans, in discrimination situations, and also where you've dissented in a situation in which your position was to support the claim of discrimination, and that it would be inaccurate to say that you have not taken that position in the 4,000-plus cases that you have decided. Is that correct?
That's certainly correct, Senator.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about precedent and stare decisis. It's certainly something that we lawyers are familiar with. We regard it as a key principle in deciding cases. There was a case that was mentioned by a couple of my Democratic colleagues that I'm sure will be discussed further, but I thought I'd give you an opportunity to talk about it because it certainly seemed to me to be a case in which you were that you were trying to apply a Supreme Court precedent, the precedent being the Lopez versus United States case, a case, by the way, in which I note that it's one of those decisions that Justice O'Connor was in the majority, a 5-4 decision, which her position could be characterized as the swing vote. Now, you in United States versus Rybar, agreed with Justice O'Connor in the way that she should apply, or the way the law should be applied relative to intrastate possession of a weapon. The Lopez case dealt with a congressional act that said that weapons should not be possessed near schools. The court struck that down, saying that that went beyond the Commerce Clause capability of commerce to legislate in matters of interstate commerce. In Rybar, what was the issue? You dissented. By the way, one of the reasons why this case is interesting to me is because the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, which is my circuit, has subsequently ruled, and this is not a conservative court in most people's estimation, recently agreed with your dissent in a case called U.S. versus Stewart, a 2003 case. In which the court overturned the defendant's conviction under the very same statute, holding that the law exceeded Congress's commerce powers. So it seems to me that it would be hard to argue that your position is per se unreasonable, but could you describe it in your own words?
Well, my position in Rybar was really a very modest position, and it did not go to the question of whether Congress can regulate the possession of machine guns. In fact, I explained in the opinion that it would be easy for Congress to do that in a couple of ways that differed from the way in which it was done in Rybar. The statute in Rybar was very similar to the statute that was at issue in Lopez. In fact, I think they are the only two federal firearms statutes that have been cast in that mold. They simply prohibited the possession of firearms without either congressional findings concerning the effect of the activity on interstate commerce or a jurisdictional element. And I knew from my experience as a federal prosecutor that most of the federal firearms statutes have a jurisdictional element right in the statute. And what that means is that when the prosecutor presents the case in court, the statute that's used most frequently is the statute that makes it a crime for someone who's been convicted of a felon to possess a firearm. And in that case, when the prosecutor presents the case in court, the prosecutor has to show that the defendant has been convicted of a felony and that the firearm in question had some connection with interstate commerce. Under Supreme Court precedent, a case called Scarborough, all that's necessary is to show that the firearm at some point in its history passed an interstate or foreign commerce. It was manufactured in one state and then later turned up in another state, or manufactured in a foreign country and brought to the United States. From my experience, this was never a practical problem, and this was how all the federal firearms statutes had been framed. But for whatever reason, the statute in Lopez and the statute in Rybar were lacking that jurisdictional element. So an easy way in which Congress could regulate the possession of a machine gun would be to insert a jurisdictional element. And as I pointed out in my experience as the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, that was never a practical problem. The Supreme Court in Lopez said that there were three reasons why there was a problem with the statute there. And that case had been decided just the year before, and it was my obligation as a lower court judge to follow it. The first was that it involved what the court characterized as a non-commercial activity, and that was the possession of a firearm. And, of course, that was exactly the same activity that was at issue in Rybar. The second was the absence of a jurisdictional element, and there was no jurisdictional element in either statute. And the third was the absence of a congressional finding connecting the activity that was being regulated with interstate commerce. And I pointed out in my opinion that I would have viewed the Rybar case very differently if there had been a congressional finding, or if the Justice Department, in presenting its argument to us, had been able to point to anything that showed that there was a substantial effect on interstate commerce, which is what the Supreme Court says is required.
So this is one of those situations in which if the result was not what was intended, you were willing to point out in your decision what Congress could relatively easily have done to get the result that it appeared that Congress wanted to achieve.
That's exactly correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Kyle. Senator Cole.
Herbert Cole of Wisconsin, a Democrat.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Judge Alito, we heard a lot of discussion yesterday about the proper role of the judge in our system. Some said that a judge should favor neither the, quote, big guy or the little guy, but simply apply the law and not make the law. Based on what you said yesterday, I believe that you would agree generally with this characterization. However, to me, it's not quite so simple. Just as no two umpires call the same game exactly, no two judges see a case in exactly the same way. Laws in the Constitution are often ambiguous and capable of many interpretations. Those interpretations are the result of judges with different judicial philosophies. Some judges have a more liberal judicial philosophy, while others are more conservative, and we're here trying to figure out what your judicial philosophy is. That's probably the principal point of this hearing. If the law were so simple, we would not have as many 5-4 decisions. Seems to me that many of the most fundamental protections of civil rights and civil liberties that we take for granted today, things such as school integration, principle of one person, one vote, the principle that the accused have a right to a lawyer in criminal cases, and the right of contraception, just to name a few, have come when judges have been willing to look beyond rigid legal doctrines that prevailed at the times of those rulings. The neutral approach, that of the judge just applying the law, is very often inadequate to ensure social progress, right historic wrongs, and protect civil liberties so essential to our democracy. So isn't it true, Judge Alito, that a neutral judge would never have reached these conclusions? In fact, for decades, courts did not reach these conclusions. So would you agree that these cases were rightly decided, number one, and required, number two, that judges apply a more expansive, imaginative view of the Constitution?
I think that the Constitution contains both some very specific provisions, and they are the job of understanding what the provision means and applying it to new factual situations that come up is relatively easy. The Constitution sets age limits, for example, for people who want to hold various federal offices, and there can't be much debate about what that means or how it applies. But it also contains some broad principles, no unreasonable searches and seizures, the guarantee that nobody will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, equal protection of the laws. And in those instances, it is the job of the judiciary to try to understand the principle and apply it to the new situations that come before the judiciary. I think the judiciary has to do that in a neutral fashion. I think judges have to be wary about substituting their own preferences, their own policy judgments, for those that are in the Constitution. They have to identify the principle that is to be applied under these broader provisions of the Constitution and apply it. But I don't see that as being the same thing as the judges injecting his or her policy views or preferences or ideas about the direction in which the society should be moving into the decision-making process.
But these decisions that, to which I just referred pushed society into new directions, and they came about, didn't they, as a result of Supreme Court's willingness, you know, to look at the Constitution in perhaps a different way, in a new way, and take a new approach and a new avenue, which is not entirely consistent with a neutral judge simply applying the law. The law is the law. It's not hard to find that out, as you somewhat suggested, if you're an umpire. A ball's a ball, a strike is a strike. I'm suggesting that it's, and I think I would like to hope you would agree, it's somewhat, if not a lot more complex and sophisticated. If it weren't true, we could have a lot of views here today. I think you're unique in many ways, and part of that is your complexity, your sophistication, your ability to look at the Constitution and, if necessary, see new meanings that weren't seen there before. Isn't that true?
Well, Senator, I would never say that it's an easy process. There are some easy cases, but there are a lot of very difficult cases. And once you've identified the principle, the job of applying it to particular cases is often not easy at all. But what the judge has to do is make sure that the judge is being true to the principle that is expressed in the Constitution and not to the judge's principle, not to some idea that the judge has. And sometimes this results in groundbreaking decisions. Sometimes that's because new issues come up. Sometimes it's because the principle that is embodied in a constitutional provision has long been neglected. That was certainly true with respect to the Equal Protection Clause. There was a long period between Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus Board of Education when the true meaning of the Equal Protection Clause was not recognized in the decisions of the Supreme Court. And when Brown was finally decided, that was not an instance of the court changing the meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. It was an instance of the court writing an incorrect interpretation that had prevailed for a long period of time.
Okay. Judge Alito, one of the ways you get at a person's judicial philosophy is to look at the people whom they admire. In an interview that you gave in 1988, you were asked about your thoughts about Judge Robert Bork's nomination, and you said, and I quote, "Judge Bork was one of the most outstanding nominees of this century," unquote. Many Americans do not share Judge Bork's narrow views about the Constitution, views that would undermine Many of the rights that we now take for granted, Judge Alito. Judge Bork thought that Americans had no constitutional right to use contraception, saying, and I quote, the right to procreate is not guaranteed explicitly or implicitly by the Constitution, unquote. Judge Bork thought minorities had no constitutional right to have their votes counted equally, saying that in guaranteeing one man, one vote, the court, quote, stepped beyond its boundaries as an original matter, unquote. In 1981, George Bork called Roe versus Wade, quote, an unconstitutional decision, serious and wholly unjustifiable usurpation of state legislative authority, unquote. In addition, he had an unreasonably broad view of executive power, claiming that a law requiring the president to obtain an order from a court before conducting surveillance in the United States and against U.S. citizens for foreign intelligence purposes was, quote, a thoroughly bad idea and almost certainly unconstitutional. Can we assume from your admiration of Judge Bork that you agree with some of these statements, or at least that you support some of these beliefs if you were sitting on the Supreme Court? Frankly, it's curious to me that someone like yourself would consider someone with his views to be, quote, one of the most outstanding nominees of this century.
Senator, when I made that statement in 1988, I was an appointee in the Reagan administration, and Judge Bork had been a nominee of the administration, and I had been a supporter of the nomination. And I don't think the statement goes beyond that. There are issues with respect to which I probably agree with Judge Bork, and there are a number of issues with which I on which I disagree with him. And most of the things that you just mentioned are things are points on which I would disagree with him. I expressed my view about Griswold earlier this morning on the issue of reapportionment. As I sit here today in 2006, and I think that's what's most relevant, I think that the principle of one person, one vote is a fundamental part of our constitutional law. And I think it would be I don't see any reason why it should be reexamined, and I don't know that anybody is asking for that to be done. Every legislative district in the country and every congressional district in the country has been reapportioned, has been redistricted numerous times in reliance on the principle of one person, one vote, and the old ways of organizing state legislatures have long been forgotten. So I think that's very well settled now in the constitutional law of our country. Under the Fourth Amendment, I have no question about the decision in United States versus United States District Court, which held, and I think that's what you were referring to, which held that a warrant is required for domestic security surveillance, and that was the decision that led to the enactment of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Of course, and I was only referring to, or trying to refer to, your quote with respect to him and the positions he held, which I suggested were at variance with the positions I thought you held, which you're affirming here in your answer. So that the quote you're pointing out was something you made as an employee of the Reagan administration?
I was, and that was in, I saw that quoted in the paper yesterday. I think that was in 1980.
Not necessarily expressing your own real views?
I was a supporter of the nominee of the administration, and he was the nominee of the administration. He was and is an accomplished scholar. He had contributed a great deal to constitutional debate with his writings. But I don't agree with him on a number of issues, and I've mentioned you've hit some of the issues on which I would definitely disagree with him.
Very good. Judge Alito, in a document appended to your job application, you also wrote that, quote, I disagree strenuously with the usurpation by the judiciary of decision-making authority that should be exercised by branches of government responsible to the electorate, unquote. The statement is especially troubling given that elsewhere in this application you wrote, quote, I developed a deep interest in constitutional law motivated in large part by disagreement with Warren Court decisions, particularly in the areas of criminal procedure, Establishment Clause, and reapportionment. Judge Alito, what Warren Court cases were you specifically talking about? Miranda, one person, one vote, any of the privacy decisions, What in particular were you talking about?
Well, Senator, I'm happy to address that. The statement was made in that 1985 form, and of course that was written 20 years ago. And in the form, what I was doing was sort of outlining the development of my thinking about constitutional law, and I went so far as to go back to my college days, which were before, of course, I had even attended law school, much less practiced law or served as a judge. I mentioned some of the leading areas that were covered by decisions of the Warren Court, and the decisions of the Warren Court really stimulated my interest in constitutional law, and I mentioned a book that had been published at the time, Alexander Bickel's book, The Supreme Court and the Idea of Progress, which was probably the first book about what you might call constitutional theory that I had read. And he was someone who I think most people would describe as a liberal, but he was a critic of the Warren Court for a number of reasons. And he was a great proponent of judicial self-restraint. And that was the main point that I took from my pre-law school study of the Warren Court. I spoke a bit about the reapportionment decisions. I don't believe that I'm quite sure I never was opposed to the one-person, one-vote concept. I do recall quite clearly that my father's work at the time, working for the New Jersey legislature and working on reapportionment, had brought to my attention the question of just how far that principle of one-person, one vote had to be taken in drawing legislative districts. The New Jersey legislature and many other legislatures at the time were trying to redraw their districts in accordance with Reynolds versus Sims, which set out the one-person, one-vote principle. But it wasn't clear how exactly equal the districts had to be in population. And in some of the late Warren Court decisions, the court seemed to suggest, did say so for congressional districts, that they had to be almost exactly equal in population. And this idea, if applied to the legislatures and to the New Jersey legislative plan, would have wiped the plan out because there were population deviations which, although not very large, were much larger than the court had said they were going to tolerate in the case of congressional districts. And I do remember that quite specifically. Professor Bickel made the argument that the court had taken the one-person, one-vote principle too far. And I know my father had said that although he thought it was a good idea, the idea of trying to get the districts to be exactly equal in population, at the expense of looking at other factors such as the shape of the district and respecting county lines or municipal lines, was a bad idea.
Judge Alito, you stated that same job application, that one element of the conservative philosophy that you believed very strongly, quote, very strongly, was the, quote, legitimacy of a government role in protecting traditional values, unquote. What traditional values were you referring to, and who decides what is a, quote, traditional value?
Well, again, I'm trying to remember what I thought about that 20 years ago, and I'm trying to reconstruct it. I think a traditional value that I probably had in mind was the ability to live in peace and safety in your neighborhood. And that was a big issue during the time of the Warren Court, and it was still a big issue in 1985 when I wrote that statement, because that was a time of very high crime rates. I think that's a traditional value. I think the ability of people to raise a family and raise their children in accordance with their own beliefs is a traditional value. I think the ability to raise a family, raise children in a way that they're not only subjected to, they're spared physical threats, but also psychological threats that can come from elements in the atmosphere is a traditional value. I think that the ability to practice your own conscience is a traditional value. That's the best I can reconstruct it now, thinking back to 1985.
Very good. Judge Alito, in Casey, you argued that the requirement that a woman notify her husband did not impose an undue burden upon a woman. You reasoned in part that the number of married women who would seek an abortion without notifying their husbands would be rather small. In other words, only some women who would be affected. The majority in that case disagreed with you and stated, quote, whether the adversely affected group is but a small fraction of the universe, a pregnant woman desiring an abortion seems to us irrelevant. The issue, unquote. This disagreement begs the question, is a constitutional right any less of a right if only one person suffers a violation, or should greater value be placed on that right if a larger number of people have that right violated?
Trying to apply the undue burden test at that time to the provisions of the Pennsylvania statute that were before the court in Casey was extremely difficult, and I can really remember wrestling with the problem, and I took it very seriously, and I mentioned that in my opinion, and it presented some really difficult issues. Part of the problem was that the law just was not very clear at that time. The undue burden standard had been articulated by Justice O'Connor in several of her own opinions, and there were just a few hints in those opinions about what she meant by it. But what she said was that an undue burden consisted of an absolute obstacle or an extreme burden. Those may not be exact quotes, but they're pretty close. And she did say that it was insufficient to show simply that a regulation of abortion would inhibit some women from going forward and having an abortion. Those were that was the information that was available in her opinions to try to understand what this test meant. And so then the question became, how do you apply that to the numerous provisions of the Pennsylvania statute that were before us? And it was a difficult task. The plaintiffs argued that all of the provisions constituted an undue burden. And when the case went to the Supreme Court, Justice Stevens agreed with that. He said they all were an undue burden. Things like a 24-hour waiting period, that was an undue burden because it would inhibit some women from having an abortion, an informed consent provision. Justice Stevens thought, and the plaintiffs argued, that would be an undue burden. The majority on my panel and the joint opinion on the Supreme Court found that most of the provisions of the statute did not amount to an undue burden. The 24-hour waiting period, the informed consent provision, and all of them. We disagreed on only one, and that was the provision regarding spousal notification with a safety valve provision there that no sort of notification was needed if the woman thought that providing the notification would present a threat of physical injury to her. And it was, I wrestled with that issue, but based on the information that I had from Justice O'Connor's opinions, it seemed to me that this was not what she had in mind. Now, that turned out not to be a correct prediction about how she herself would apply the undue burden standard to that statutory provision, but that was the best I could do under the circumstances.
Judge Alito, in your 1985 job application memo again, you identified reapportionment as one of the three issues decided by the Warren Court with which you disagreed. You even stated that your disagreement was so strong that it was one of the reasons that you became a lawyer. Supreme Court's Warren Court decisions on this topic, of course, stood for the fundamental principle of one person, one vote, meaning as a matter of constitutional law that each person's vote must count equally and each electoral district must have the same population. These decisions were more than 20 years old by the time of your 1985 job application. And these decisions stand for a fundamental principle of democracy. By 1985, virtually no serious scholar or constitutional lawyer could be found to disagree with the principle that each person's vote should count equally. So what was your disagreement with the Warren Court's decisions on this issue, Judge Alito, in 1985? Isn't one person, one vote basic principle of democracy? Wasn't it in 1985?
Senator, I don't believe that I disagreed with the principle of one person, one vote in 1985. I was talking about how I got interested in constitutional law back in college, and I was certainly stimulated at that time by my consideration of the issue of one person, one vote. But the issue that troubled me toward the end of the Warren Court, and this was during the time when I was in college, was the question of how far this principle went when it came to drawing legislative districts. Did they have to be almost exactly equal in population in accordance with the last census, or were larger population variations permitted? In a case called Kirkpatrick versus Priestler and another one called Wells versus Rockefeller that were decided around 1969, which was right at the end of Chief Justice Warren's tenure on the Supreme Court, the court held that in the case of congressional districts, they had to be almost exactly equal in population. And as I said, my father was deeply involved in this when the issue came up again in the context of congressional districting in Karcher versus Daggett, which was around 1985. That was the case where he had been an expert witness, and the court struck down the New Jersey congressional districting plan, even though the population variations were under 1%. Now, the court also later said that when you're talking about legislative districts, considerably larger deviations are allowed, and you can take into account municipal lines and county lines and things of that nature. But as of the time when I was in college, as of the time of the two cases that I mentioned, it seemed likely, a lot of people thought, and certainly I as a college student thought that the rule was going to be the same for congressional districts as it was for legislative districts. And that seemed to say that the districts would have to be almost exactly equal in population based on the last census. Now, a problem with that is that while the census is very accurate, it's not perfect, and it doesn't stay accurate throughout the 10-year period from census to census. People move around, population grows, population diminishes in certain areas. So it didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense, let's say, in the middle of a decade to insist on absolute population equality based on the last previous census when everybody knew that the census figures had changed. And in doing that, insisting on practically equal population districts, districts of almost exactly equal population, you disregard municipal lines, you disregard county lines, people don't know which district they're going to be voting in. You introduce the possibility of other factors figuring into the districting plan.
Right. Okay. Family and Medical Leave Act, Judge Alito. In my view, one of the most important pieces of social legislation enacted in the last two decades was the Family and Medical Leave Act in 1993. Among other things, it gives employees the right to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave to care for a newborn child or an ill parent or a spouse. Statute also gives an employee the right to sue his or her employer for damages. The employer violates the employee's rights under this law. I was disturbed to learn that in the Chittister case, Judge Alito, your ruling denied a state employee the ability to sue his employer for money damages. Your reasoning was directly repudiated by the 2003 Supreme Court decisions of Nevada Department of Human Resources versus Hibbs. In that case, the Supreme Court, in a decision written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, held that the Family Medical Leave Act was congruent and proportional Congress's interest in preventing